Let me just be precise. Now I'm in Berlin, no longer at Chapman, but yeah, I'm always happy to be associated with Chapman University. So yeah, thanks, Ellie. Let me start by saying that it's a very great pleasure for me to have this opportunity to talk here to this audience. And so I've decided not to talk anymore about some past kind of established results, but to talk about future research. In particular, I'm going to talk about the topic I cared the most about, okay? So what I'm mostly passionate about. And so this topic is really about try to advance a proposal to get a better understanding of quantum theory. Another way of saying this is to go beyond the standard ontological model framework or standard hidden variable model framework. And what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to propose a new ontological framework that doesn't suffer of the problems of the previous one. So let me also say that this is, I'm going to take quite an unconventional point of view, and that this is really a work in progress at the very early stages. But the reason why I present this is because I'm really curious to know what you think about that, and any feedback is very much appreciated. So let me start by saying what is the motivation, which is like this 100 years old question. So we would like to get a better understanding of quantum theory, of this abstract formalism of quantum theory. And in particular with this, I mean, I would like to understand really what is the picture of the world that is entailed by the formalism of quantum theory, obtain an unambiguous interpretation of the nature of the quantum reality. And in addition to this motivation, I wanted to add another one, which is more like a funny fact, but I thought I really had to share it with you. So a couple of days ago, I was just reading the Italian news. Nothing really interested about that, but I received as an advert like this, probably because I was Googling a lot of quantum stuff, like this t-shirt with the quote from Feynman about the impossibility of understanding quantum mechanics. And so I decided to take this as an extra motivation, you know, understand quantum theory so that, you know, we can get rid of this merchandise or questionable aesthetic. And yeah, let me also state publicly that I didn't buy it. But so coming back to the serious stuff, get a better understanding of quantum theory. Before telling you what is the approach I'm going to follow, I just wanted to make a couple of comments on, you know, lines of research that have tried to answer this question. So the first one is the line of research about, you know, all these interpretations of quantum theory and people that try to, you know, keep doing research on already established interpretations. So my challenge to these people is try to, you know, pick your favorite interpretation and try to develop a precise mathematical framework for the notion of reality that this framework endorses, and then test this notion against the statistics of quantum theory and see if you have like no theorems or what are the features that are bonuses in your notion of reality endorsed by your interpretation. I think that many interpretations would really benefit from doing that. The other comment is about this operational approaches like axiomatization of quantum theory, reconstructing quantum theory from operational axioms. So personally, I really like these works. I think are really gorgeous pieces of research, but I think they still don't get us, you know, the understanding of quantum theory, because they don't tell us what are the elements of reality, like what is the picture of the world entailed by quantum theory. And, you know, usually these works are motivated by, you know, try to build an analogy with how it is constructed, the theory of special relativity, you know, that is singled out by these two basic principles. But I think there is a difference between the approaches, because in the theory of relativity, I think that the basic principle really carry some ontological weight, okay? They really tell you what is the reality of space and time. Instead, in these other approaches, we still don't have that. And let me say that I'm not criticizing this work, but the point I wanted to make here is that I think that in order to understand quantum theory, we need to get the ontological framework right. We need to get the ontological framework right. That's the goal, and that's what I'm going to try to do in this work and in my future research. So what is the approach I'm going to follow here? So I think that in order to get a better understanding of quantum theory, first, what we need to do is we need to single out what are the features of quantum theory that really constitute a departure from the classical worldview, that we can really say that they are inherently non-classical in a mathematically rigorous way. And so far, the features that we can consider as such are the ones that comes from the famous no-go theorems like Bell's theorem, Cohen-Sperker, and many others. And every time, the structure of these theorems is the following. So we have a notion of reality, which is encoded in this ontological model framework or a hidden variable model framework. And then we have a notion of classicality, which is rigorously defined in this ontological model framework. And then basically we prove a contradiction between the statistics of this ontological model framework with this classical feature and the statistics of quantum theory. And usually, you know, the way to go is to say that we need to renounce the classical feature, or at least what emerges as notion of non-classicality is, you know, the violation of this classical feature. For example, in Bell's theorem, this classical feature is Bell local causality. And usually we say that the feature, the non-classical feature is non-locality. For Cohen-Specker theorem is contextuality and so on. At this point, you might ask yourself, like, okay, but is there like a common aspect among all these features coming from these no-go theorems that are truly non-classical? And I mean, one answer to this is that there is such common aspect, and it is the fact that these features, so non-locality, contextuality, and so on, all involves fine tunings or fine-tuned properties. So what are these fine tunings? So the idea is that fine tunings are properties that hold at the operational level, but break in the ontological level. So at the level of the picture of reality you give your theory. More precisely, fine-tuned properties are properties that hold at the level of the operational statistics predicted by the physical theory, but do not hold at the level of the model of the reality, the ontological model associated to the theory. So for example, let's take Bell's theorem. So if you accept that the lesson is that the quantum world is described by a non-local ontological model, this means that there is a property that holds at the operational level as predicted by quantum theory, which is no signaling, but this is broken in any ontological model of the theory. Another example is generalized contextuality. So if you accept that the lesson of the non-contextuality theorems is that the quantum world is described by a contextual ontological model, this means that there are some experimental procedures that are operationally indistinguishable in principle according to the theory, but still at the level of the model of the reality, these are distinct, okay? And so this another way of telling these things is to say that these properties would only arise by a fine tuning of the ontic parameters, and that's why the name fine tunings. Let me say that in this paper with Matt Liefer, we provide a precise mathematical framework for these fine tunings. We call them operational fine tunings to differentiate them from the causal fine tuning in the causal model framework. And this notion of operational no fine tuning, this requirement is related to this other notion named Leibnizianity in this other paper. I can comment more on these things, but really the only point I wanted to make here is that if you accept that the quantum world is described by an ontological model, it means that you accept the existence of these fine-tuned properties. And for me, this is not a viable option. And the reason is that if you accept this fine-tuning, you're accepting that your explanation of the statistics of the theory, your description of the world is a conspiratorial one. It's like saying that nature, is characterized with a conspiratorial connotation, is hiding from us, for example, the possibility of signaling Bell's theorem or the possibility of distinguishing operational experimental procedures that we experience as the same. And so for this reason, so for this fine-tuning problem associated with the no-go theorems, I believe that the lesson to take from the no-go theorems is that we should abandon the standard ontological model framework as the way to model reality, okay? Let me say just for completeness and clarity that if you want to renounce to these fine tunings, there is also another possible option, which is the one of explaining this fine tuning as emergent from yet undiscovered physical mechanisms. A golden example of this is Valentini's version of Bohmian mechanics, where you explain the fine-tuned properties of no signaling by saying that actually, you know, there is signaling in the world, but I tell you a reason why you don't experience it. And the reason is that there is this equilibration process such that we only see no signaling. I have another project running where we try to give a similar explanation for the case of contextuality, where basically we say, look, you don't see the differences between these experimental procedures that you always see as operational equivalent, But the reason, actually, they are distinct in reality. And the reason why you don't see them is because there is a process of erasure of information proper to quantum theory. So you can go this way. But the problem with this approach is that every time, ultimately, you need to renounce to some basic principles of physics. So, for example, in Valentini's version of Bohmian mechanics, you had to renounce to no signaling. In this other approach, it was describing with contextuality as erasure of information. You need to, in the end, assume that there exist measurements that are more distinguishing than the ones allowed by quantum theory. And so I think that for this reason, this is not really the most promising option. The most promising option, as I'm going to try to argue in this entire talk, is really that we should abandon the standard ontological models framework. And so let me be clear again about what is the goal now. The goal is to develop a new theory-independent ontological framework different from the standard ontological model framework, so that it's going to endorse a different notion of reality, that when compared with the statistics of quantum theory, it doesn't suffer of these no-go theorems. It doesn't suffer of this fine-tuning problem. Okay? So is the goal clear and the story behind it clear? Comments, questions? Okay, so if there is not... Then, now really, the question is, so how can we come up with a new ontological framework, you know, different from the standard ontological model framework? And I think the answer to this is that first, we should really analyze the standard ontological model framework and understand what are the parts of it that are not really natural and we should change. And so this is now what exactly what I'm going to do. So before telling you about my proposal, I want to analyze the standard ontological model framework. And let me say about this that now I'm going to first describe it as it is usually done, and many people here have heard this many times, but listen to it anyway, because I'm going to highlight some aspects that usually are not highlighted. So standard ontological models framework. So in order to define it, first we need to describe what is called an operational approach to physical theories. So at this stage, we don't believe in the existence of any like system or underlying reality. We just look at physical theories just as operational theories, as tools. So a physical theory, this approach is just a tool to predict the statistics of outcomes from experimental procedures. So really, we are just looking at the predictive power, the predictive aspect of a physical theory. And so like if now we imagine these experimental procedures such as list of instructions of what to see in the lab, and we can categorize them into preparation, transformation, and measurements, the role of a physical theory is just to really give us the rule to compute this probability of obtaining an outcome given preparation, transformation, and measurements, okay? And under this light, quantum theory, you know, is described as follows. So it associates density operators to preparations, CPTP maps to transformations, and POVMs to measurement. And the only thing that matters in an operational approach about quantum theory is the Bohr rule. So which is the, you know, exactly how quantum theory prescribes that we obtain the statistics that we see in the lab. So it just, you know, the standard trace rule. But, you know, like at this point, you might believe that if a theory is successful in predicting things and so that the rule works, it's because there is a reason, no? There must be a reason why the theory is successful in predicting things. And so now we might want to characterize the theory not just from the point of view of its predictive aspect, predictive power, but also from the point of view of the explanatory power. And in particular, we might believe that the reason why the theory works is exactly because there are systems that are the subject of these experimental procedures, and these systems have properties, okay, that explain all the regularities and the predictions. In particular, now I can define an ontological model of an operational theory, and here I'm going to define this standard ontological model framework. And according to this framework, the system has definite properties even if there is no observer and no experiment. So even if it's not in relation with anything else, it's just an individual unit, the system. Particularly, I wanted to really quote the original you know, source. This is one of the first paper on that, where it says about the ontological model framework, these systems are presumed to have attributes regardless of whether they are being subjected to experimental tests, and regardless of what anyone knows about them. These attributes describe the real state of affairs of the system. Thus, a specification of which instance of each attribute applies at a given time, we call the ontic state of the system. So really, the systems are really like things in itself that exist, like even if they're not in relation with anything else. And so we call these properties of the systems like the ontic states. And crucially, these are represented by points in a measurable space, okay? And because this is really what mathematically represents this idea that these are really individual units, you know, that are enduring unchanging substances. Moreover, this ontological model prescribes that experimental procedures like preparations are associated to probability distributions over this ontic state space that we call big lambda, where the ontic states live. Same for the measurement elements and for the transformation. I mean, the transformation are going to be like general matrices of probabilities. And moreover, the consistency with the statistics of the physical theory are going to be given by classical probability theory. So basically, we apply the law of total probability, and an ontological model of a given physical theory has to give, you know, the statistics consistent with the physical theory. Let me say that, you know, this framework is very general. And, you know, for example, if you want to have an ontological model of classical Hamiltonian mechanics, then it's sensible that you assume that your lambdas are like points in the phase space, evolutions are, you know, given by deterministic functions. For the case of quantum theory, there are many proposals of what lambda could be. For example, a wave function can be part of the description of lambda or not, and so on. And now what I want to do is just, I wanted to list what are, I think, the achievements of this standard ontological model framework and like, I would say like the good features it has. Okay, so first of all, I think it's the only really precise mathematical way I know to mathematize a notion of reality, okay? And in particular, it does it in the most natural way, if you want, you know. Why do we see regularities in the world? Why a theory predicts well? Oh, because there is an external world, you know, that we need just by making observation, discover what it is about. And, you know, that external world exists, even if it's not in relation with anything else. Moreover, as I said, like this ontological model framework is very general. Like the lambdas can be anything, can be like points in the phase space, the wave function, fields, whatever you like. And moreover, it's theory independent. Like you can build an ontological model for any operational theory you want, classical theory, quantum theory, the theory you came up this morning at breakfast, and so on. And moreover, I think probably the most if you want important things, is that has allowed to rigorously define the features of quantum theory or even other theories that are truly non-classical, okay? And in particular, it does so with the no-go theorems, as I said before. Here, nowadays, there are many no-go theorems, you know, that are, you know, maybe less famous than the Bell or Cohen-Specker. And maybe here I can add also that I contributed myself to this part with some recent results on what is classical and non-classical about interference or about uncertainty relations. And then also in the past, I also work quite a lot on what is called the psi-epistemic view of quantum states, where, you know, you interpret the wave function as a state of knowledge rather than a state of reality. And this because, yes, like in this framework, you can also ask and study this question, like, is the wave function epistemic or ontic? And I think this is yet another achievement of the framework. But now what I wanted to focus on is when I say that it mathematizes a notion of reality, I want to ask about what notion of reality really the standard ontological models framework embraces, okay? So what picture of the world an ontological model describes, or if you want, what category of pictures of the world, because clearly, like, depending on what we choose to be lambda and what operational theory we are testing, it's going to change what's the picture of the world. What category of pictures of the world the ontological model describes? And you know, like in preparation of this part, there was, you know, like, you know, like preparing many slides on the history of the notion of reality in the Western philosophy. But in the end, I realized that the, you know, the relevant information was all contained in the notion of reality that was endorsed already in the scientific revolution. So here we're talking about the, you know, 16th, 17th century. We have like Galilei, Newton, Bacon. At that time, people have started, you know, to pursue knowledge of nature. So if you want, like, scientific knowledge, not by following, you know, what Aristotle said, but like really performing experiments that have to be reproducible. And so if, like, empiricism was the methodology, the ontology that they were adhering to was the one of materialism. So reality was really made of material stuff that exists, even if they're not in relation with anything else. And really it's about this enduring and changing substance, which is of material nature. Moreover, the picture of the world was the one of a machine. Okay, so they were endorsing what is called mechanicism. So where basically there are all these material causes that influence other material stuff. And if you want, this was also in line with the discoveries of the time, you know, like the mechanical clock. So the reason why it gives you time is not a miracle, but it's because there are some wheels that touch some others and so on. And so, like, really material causes, you know, that influence each other and explain the phenomena. Moreover, there was all this emphasis of removal of the subjectivity and really remove, you know, like, getting the reality means really to, you know, get, you know, what is this material stuff about, which is really independent on being in relation with anything else. And let me call this worldview scientific materialism, okay? And now what I wanted to argue is that scientific materialism is exactly the notion of reality, which is endorsed by the standard ontological model framework. So with the lambda, what we want to capture is exactly, you know, this material stuff that are these systems, you know, you remember that have properties that are independent or being in relation with anything else and being observed by anyone. And now the question I wanted to ask is, given that the ontological models framework embraces scientific materialism, the question is that, but is the latter the only way of having a notion of reality? Or maybe, you know, like, in philosophy, there have been many other proposals, and maybe we can turn some of these proposals into a theory-independent mathematical framework and test it against the statistics of quantum theory. Maybe, you know, like, after all, the lesson of quantum theory is just that we need to abandon scientific materialism as the way to conceive reality. And also, let me say that, I mean, with all of this, I don't want to say that we need to go to some bizarre, exotic notions of reality, like many words, or I don't know. Actually, I think our strategy should be really to be, you know, like radical only when it's really needed. And honestly, what we should do is we should look at the standard ontological model framework and the scientific materialism and try to identify what are the aspects, some assumptions that they have, they are not really natural, you know? Some abstractions that are not necessary. And so now I'm gonna give you my proposal for a new ontological framework that really, I think, describes a new notion of reality that, you know, like, removes some of these abstractions of the standard ontological models. And so this notion of reality originates from the following principle. So the principle is that for something to exist is for something to be recorded. For something to exist is for something to be recorded. So there is this identification between, like, memory and existence, memory and ontology. And that's where the standard ontological models framework was lying about, because it was saying that things exist even if it cannot be recorded by anything else anywhere. But look, if you think, like, you know, we cannot really draw a difference between something that we say it exists and something that there is, that we say doesn't exist, and something that we say there is no memory about it anywhere in the world. And so I really believe that this principle removes some unnecessary assumptions from the standard ontological model framework. And now let me explore a bit the consequences of this principle.
Lorenzo.
Yes.
Can I just ask a question about the principle? So recorded, you mean it has to be actually observed by someone, or it's like recordable? It's possible to be recorded.
No, I mean actually recorded. And now I'm gonna, okay, with the considerations I'm gonna make, I'm gonna be clear on this.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so considerations. So the first consideration is that, you remember before the ontic state in the scientific materialism, in the standard ontological model framework, was really about you know, a point in a measurable space. It was really this individual unit, independent of being in relation with anything else. Now, instead, the ontic state is going to be associated with the collection of all the memories that there are about a system. And if we, you know, in light of, you know, removing abstractions, we should also assume that, you know, any recorder, which is just any other system, is of finite extent, and therefore it can never, you know, record with the infinite precision, for example, with the precision of a point. It doesn't have infinite memory capacity. So as a consequence here, the ontic states are not going to be associated with the points, because we would need infinite information to describe a point. But instead, it's going to be associated with other elements. So the first consideration is that ontic states cannot be represented by points as a consequence of the principle. Moreover, the notion of reality here that emerges is really relational, because we can say that something exists only if it's recorded by something else. I want also to emphasize that there is no special role of the subject, like the subject is just any other system which is you know, recorded and records. Moreover, the picture of the world is really interconnected here. So in particular, if in the scientific materialism, the picture of the world was one of a machine with material causes, here, the picture of the world is more, if you want, the one of an organism, where, you know, individual parts don't have like individual existence. Within the definition of something is already the relation it has with the rest. It doesn't make sense to talk about just the individual parts. And if you want, more than the picture of the world being the one of an organism, is like a computing organism, because it's based on this recording. It's like a computer. And the role of a physical theory in this picture of the world is really to tell what are the rules for this recording and acquisition of information. But really, so if in the scientific materialism, like the entities were these material substances, this material stuff, here the entities are the processes, and the properties are the rules of these processes. But yeah, I wanted to give a cartoon of what's the picture of the world here. You can imagine that now any interaction happen in the universe, you can imagine this interaction as being, you know, read as some reciprocal, you know, transfer and recording of information. We can imagine we call one system observer and the other is just the system that is recorded. So we can imagine this also, I don't know, like my phone here and my pen, touching each other. This is just reciprocal acquisition of information. And so we can imagine that, you know, like S2 is getting, is recording, sorry, about S1, but then there are other systems that record other parts and so on. And so you see like the ontic state, if you want to associate to S1, is really the collection of all these recordings. And so you see that also like the notion of space time here emerges as like a pattern of relationships. And so like the short summary of this is that if before in the ontological models framework, reality was really about stuff, in this, let me call it memory ontology framework, because it, you know, originates from the principle that for something to exist is for something to be recorded, then are the processes, the entities. And what is really enduring and unchanging is no longer the substance as before, but it's the structure of the process. So at this point, you might you know, like this proposal or not, but I think that in order to evaluate this proposal, what we really, you know, what is at stake is if we can put this proposal into a precise theory-independent mathematical framework and see if it can help with the problem of fine tunings and with the understanding of quantum theory. And that's what I'm gonna do next. But yeah, let me pause it in case there are some comments or questions.
Yeah, I have a question, Lorenzo. Can you just repeat the first point on your previous slide? Is that the ontic state should not be points? Can you just repeat the reasoning you gave about that?
Yes. So, the reasoning is the following: is that if we assume that any recorder has finite extent, and so it doesn't have infinite memory capacity, then for sure it cannot record with the precision of a point, because in order to record with the precision of a point, I would need infinite memory to store all the digits that describe a point. And so as a consequence, It's like constant.
So you're basically saying it can't be a point in a continuous manifold, but it could be a point in a discrete set, like relative to the argument you just gave. There's no contradiction with having the ontic state of some system be a point in a discrete set, correct?
What's the difference between discrete set and continuous set?
Well, a discrete set, I should have said a sort of finite cardinality discrete set. So if I have a set of, four ontic states,
yeah,
there aren't an infinite number of elements there, unlike a continuous manifold. So infinite precision argument, it really rules, it is about the cardinality of that set. It can't be infinite because you don't have infinite precision recordings.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're not ruling out finite cardinality sets of ontic states.
Yeah. I think I can subscribe to that. But it's more probable that reality is about continuum. A continuum set.
So that last comment, you said.
That can be a possibility. Yeah. Because let me say this, like now I'm taking this route. Because I think I have a concrete proposal for a mathematical framework how to do that. But actually, one of the questions I'm left with at the end is if there are other possibilities to implement the principle, and maybe consider a discrete set is, and still having points is a possibility.
Okay, but let me just see if I understood your last comment, which is, it sounded to me like you're saying, a continuous set of ontic states kind of makes more sense. And so, if this notion of reality's recording is correct, then because this discrete ontic space feels like it can't do the job, therefore we need something else. Is that the idea that?
Yeah. I still don't feel like completely ruling out the possibility that there is a discrete set describing the reality. Just not what I'm pursuing here now. But yeah, maybe it's another possibility.
Okay, thanks.
That's all I'm saying. I haven't thought through much about this a discrete ontology like with finite cardinality, but maybe it's a possibility. Good. So as I was saying, now the question is how to implement this new proposal. So for something to exist is for something to be recorded, and all the picture of the word I said into a rigorous theory-independent mathematical framework. So let me say that, if you read the abstract I made circulate before the talk, maybe the abstract alluded to the fact that I actually have this framework, but that is a lie. What I have is just, some concrete intuitions and some, a partially complete framework that now I'm going to tell you about. But again, this is really a work in progress. I'm going to also... put forth some speculations here. So let us start. So as we're just discussing, so the starting point is that now we can no longer associate ontic states with the points in a measurable space. But instead we want to start with something that describes the recording, which is unavoidably like finite. So in particular, I want to start with a spot instead of a point. And the spot is just an open set. And now I want to build what is like a non-tick state space. Okay, so in particular, I want to build a topological space where then on top of it, I can define a measure theory and a probability theory so that I can test my new ontological model against any operational theory. So test, compare their statistics. So how do I do that? So for sure, if I want to build a topological space, so what I do is I start from this spot, then I need to say that if I take an intersection of two spots, this is also going to be a valid spot. Then if I take an amalgamation of different spots, this is also a valid spot. Moreover, if I take a amalgamation of many spots such that I span the whole space, that's also a valid spot. And the same has to be true for the empty set. Moreover, the minimum I can assume is that this operation of intersection distributes over this amalgamation. And basically what I've done so far is just to list all the axioms of what defines a topological space. And as a matter of fact, this construction I just made is something that is already is an object that is already known in mathematics. It was studied at the beginning of the last century in the 30s. And it's called a locale or a point-free topological space, okay? Point-free because it's really, it's a definition of a topological space that, but that does not start from points, okay? And so if you want like the mathematical definition, a locale is a complete lattice, we're gonna call it V, that satisfies the distributive law. So you see like this intersection distributes over these amalgamations, okay? But you know, with this, we're going into some abstract maths. I don't want to go into that. If you're interested about, point-free topology, apparently this is the Bible of point-free topology, this book here. But instead, what I want to focus here is what are the aspects of this point-free topology that are good for implementing our new ontological framework, our new proposal, and if they're good for solving the problem of fine tunings. So where we have landed at the moment is on the following, that what was before an ontic state, which was a point in a measurable set, now the ontic state of a system is a spot in a locale. So it's this open set in a point-free topological space. And we're going to denote this with a small v. And the new ontic state space is big V. Okay, so this is like the replacement of the lambda before. And now what I want to do is that I want to give some examples of locales to highlight what are the features that I think are relevant for us. In particular, I wanted to start with this simple example of a locale, which is what are called the regular opens of the reals. Okay, so this is the set that is composed by all the open set of the real numbers, such that these are coincide with the interior of their closure. So what does it mean? So that the closure of an open set is if you also consider the boundary of the set, the interior is if you consider, you know, like the interior, so the union of the open subsets. And why this is a relevant example? Because if you look in this set, points are not included, because if you take the closure of a point is a point and the interior is the empty set, so points do not exist in this set. So this is an example of a locale that does not have an analog in a point topology. So you can imagine like having the reals without the points, okay? And you can imagine to take all open sets within it. So you might think again that this is like a mathematical abstraction, but let me disagree with that. In particular, imagine the following. So if I ask you, imagine you have all the real numbers, okay? And then you have all the real numbers, but without the zero, okay? And then I ask you, is there a way like operationally to differentiate between these two sets? Well, the answer is that no, there is no way. Because if you imagine now that you ask, oh, let me check if there is the zero or no, operationally, what you can do is just to perform a measurement that is gonna result just in putting like an open set around the zero. Then if you ask, is the zero there or not? Then the answer would be, I don't know. And every time you don't know. And you can extend this reasoning to any point. So you see that if you just now rely on some Occam razor reasoning, you see that points are not really necessarily to describe the physics or what you can operationally access. So again, like points are sheer abstractions, like in the standard ontological model framework, like using locales and point-free topology bring us closer to the physics. And now, given this example,
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Are you allowing infinite intersections in these spots or open sets?
Yes. Yeah, in the definition.
There is, can't you then reconstruct the point?
Sorry, didn't hear?
If you allow infinite intersections of these spots, shouldn't you be able to reconstruct the points?
Yeah, so, okay, this is a good point. That so in this framework, it's not that there is not the concept of point, okay? The point is that the concept of point is emergent. You know, you don't start from points, you start from open spots. And then you can get points also as a limit where you take spots to be arbitrarily small. But the whole point is that you don't start from points. But yeah, good question. So what I want to say now is that given this example of the regular opens of the reels, I wanted to highlight what is, I think, the most relevant feature for us about point-free topology. And intuitively, I want to describe it as follows, that in the theory of locals, there are in general more sub-objects than in standard point topology. So let me take again the examples. Imagine now that we have the real numbers, okay, also with the points and everything, and we interpret this as a locale instead of a point topological space. Now you see that in this locale, we have extra sub-objects because, for example, the regular opens I showed before are a sub-object that only belongs to the theory of locales, but not if you considered the reals as a point topology space. So you see there is more stuff. But more than this, the comment I wanted to make is that things become interesting in point-free topology where you start cutting things. So there is this idea that if you cut a locale, what you get is not just the individual parts, but even something more. So imagine, for example, if you take the reals before and you cut in the zero, then you have two open sets that are the ones at the left and the right of the zero, but you don't have the zero in neither of them. So if you want to reconstruct back the previous locale, it feels like only having the two open sets is not enough. So this is to say that the theory of locale embraces this idea that the whole is greater than the parts. And I really like this in terms of trying to implement this memory ontology, because it's like saying, look, when you define something, it's not just an individual unit, like in the standard ontological model frame or like in standard point topology. Every time you define something, you need to define it also in terms of the relationship it has with something else. And so when you cut a locale and you create two individual units, then you also have some information going around about the relationship they had. And this is the extra sub-objects that a locale has, okay? And this might sound a bit abstract to you, but for example, it was used, this idea of locales, to solve in maths a very famous paradox, which is this Banach-Tarski paradox. I'm sure you've heard it many times. So the paradox says that, you can take a 3D Euclidean sphere, cut it in a particular way, and reassemble the pieces such that you create two 3D Euclidean spheres of the same size, okay? So this is really a puzzle. But in the theory of locales, this is no longer a puzzle, because when you cut things in a particular way, you always have extra stuff. And you can use this extra stuff, which is really the information about the relationship between the individual parts, as a resource to create new things. If you're interested about the details of this, I just refer to this paper here where they actually show how to use the theory of locales to solve this Banach-Tarski paradox. The only other two things I want to say about locales are the following. So the first is that if we accept the theory of locales, it means also that we are accepting to go from the Boolean logic of standard point topologies, the standard ontological model framework, to the intuitionistic logic. So what is the intuitionistic logic? It's just Boolean logic where you renounce to the principle of excluded middle. So now it's no longer true that a proposition is either true or false. But as I was saying before, because you have this extra, stuff that is not just the parts of a locale, then you also have the possibility of having something that is neither true or false, but you don't know what it is, okay? So it's like saying if you associate a proposition, I don't know, A to an open set, then not A is associated to the biggest open set outside of it, but this does not coincide with the complement of the open set. So there is still something more. And so the principle of excluded middle is broken, intuitionistic logic. And this is also related to the fact that when you want to build a probability theory on locales, you have some issues. And that's also why the probability of locale, as of now, is still not established, okay? There is no consistent probability theory of locale. Because the idea is that you have problems like enforcing the principle of what is called like a finite additivity. So a probability of a locale is not equal to the sum of the probability of the sublocales, exactly because there are these extra things, okay? And so like with this, I just wanted to recap where we are at now. So we started with the ontological model framework, reality is made of stuff, represented by points in a measurable space, you get the consistency with the operational statistics of the theory via classical probability theory. And then we have this memory ontology framework where the reality is made of processes, and what were before the ontic states now are spots in a locale. And still there is not a well-defined probability theory that allows us to say how you really get the consistency with the operational statistics of your theory that you're testing. And this is really where I'm saying that this is a work in progress. This is really what has to be done here. But nevertheless, I want to share now some ways on how to do that. And in particular, because, you know, at this point, probably you're asking yourself, I mean, come on, Lorenzo, I mean, you told us that you wanted to understand quantum theory and solve the problem of fine tunings of the no-go theorems. How can this framework about locales and spots in locales can help us with that? And that's exactly what I want to address now, okay? So how can this framework help us resolving the problem of fine tunings? Another way of saying this is, how can this framework can turn the no-go theorems into go theorems? So where now we could actually say that quantum theory is consistent with the notion of local causality, non-contextuality, and so on, exactly because we have changed the ontological model framework. In particular, now what I'm going to do is that I'm going to only focus on Bell's theorem. This is really the last thing I'm gonna say. So, you know, Bell's theorem. So Bell's theorem here, let me just briefly recap how it is, the standard formulation. So we have our Bell scenario where you have two parties, Alice and Bob. They share a bipartite system, a source of photons that are preparing some states. So they go, let's say, space-like separated, or in general, they just perform two individual local measurements on their parts. We associate the choice of settings of the measurements with X and Y. The outcomes are A and B, and these are all binary variables. And then the story is that we perform these experiments, you know, many times. We collect the statistics, P of A, B given X, Y. Then what we do is that we test the statistics predicted by a non-ontological model. So where we associate, you know, a non-ontic state lambda to the source of photon to the common cause. And we assume this notion of Bell local causality. And then we compare the statistics predicted by these models, assuming local causality, with the statistics of quantum theory. What we find is that these are not compatible. In particular, this assumption of Bell's local causality can be thought as decomposed into two assumptions. The first one is this Reichenbach principle of common cause. So if we have two variables that are statistically dependent, either one causes the other or vice versa, or they have a common cause in their past, and in particular, their probabilities, conditional probabilities in this case, factorize. And moreover, the assumption about the relativistic causal structure. So events can be influenced only by events that happen in their past light cone. And this is, you know, in accordance with the theory of relativity. What happens is that if you assume this Bell's local causality and the standard ontological model framework, is that this probability of AB given XY lambda factorizes in this way. And as a consequence, you can build this CHSH expression, and you can show that this is bounded by some value, okay? And this is a Bell inequality. However, you can show that quantum theory violates it. And this is the standard treatment of Bell's theorem, okay? But now the question is, what if we substitute this lambda, which was a point in a measurable set, like in the standard ontological models framework, with a recording, you know, with a spot in a locale, okay? In order to answer this question, of course, we need a probability theory on locales, okay, that we don't have yet. But I'm sure, and here comes a bit of intuition and speculation, I'm sure that whatever that theory of probability is going to have this feature, so that the probability associated to a spot, okay, so B is the spot that is associated to is the element of reality of the bipartite system, is going to be greater than the probability of the union of the subspots. So if you assume that the spot is divided into subspots, then the probability of the whole is greater than the probability of the parts, of the sum of the probability of the subspots, okay? And now I think it's sensible to assume that every time you perform a measurement, for example, Alice and Bob perform a measurement on their bipartite system, then this involves a cut in the spot, okay? And in particular, these subspots that originate are the ones associated with the outcome, with the observable properties. But instead, what is not associated with observable properties is this information about the relationship, is this extra stuff that comes when you break a locale, when you break a spot. And now what I think is sensible to do is to assume that Bell local causality only applies to these subspots, okay? To this, we can call it, I call it V-cut, to say it's the spot after the cut, which is just a collection of these subspots, okay? That are just the new recordings that happen when Alice and Bob perform the measurements, okay? And so if we do that, now it's conceivable to assume that the probability of AB given XYV, which is the one that goes into the CHSH expression, is greater than the probability when instead we consider only this, this collection of subspots. But now Bell's local causality only applies to this part, okay? Because this is the observable part. And so this is the part that factorizes. And I think that this can give a possibility for the CHSH expression now to have a bigger value, to be bounded by a higher upper bound. And so maybe this time, the statistics of quantum theory are consistent with this new Bell inequality, are consistent with this local causality in this framework where reality associated with recordings. And let me exaggerate the speculation here. If we imagine that we tailor now a model within this memory ontology framework for quantum theory, maybe this model of quantum theory just says that you have a finite amount of extent for this spot, and maybe it's related to h bar or the Planck constant, and that's the reason why we get exactly 2√2 as a upper bound. So the bottom line here is that maybe this is too much of a speculation, but in this view, the way you explain Bell's theorem is that if you have a highly entangled state, a highly correlated Bell-Parseis state, and you perform two appropriate measurements, so what happens is that you cut in a particular way the spot, so the recording associated to the element of reality associated to this bipartite system, and then you have that what contributes to the joint probability is not just the probability of the individual parts, but also the probability about the relation, the correlation that this time is big, and this happens even if Alice and Bob go space like separated. Okay, so having said that. Now I just want to say what I think is next to do. Marina was asking a question, I think.
Yeah, so in the previous slide, you said that the local causality only applies to the second. No, that's like, yeah. The local causality only applies to the second one because V-cut is the thing that's observable. But then in this case, wouldn't you have a problem in superluminal resolutions, like that say, okay, so superluminal signaling is not observed, but in the ontology, it is allowed. So in your case, local causality is not a requirement for the ontology, but it's just a requirement for something that's observed. So wouldn't you have the same problem?
Yeah, so I think the way you explain it is that, so in the ontology, you also have local causality, is exactly what is enforced here, but only to the part that pertains to, the collection of subspots. And that's where you enforce it. Somehow you give an explanation to, what is the extra part, which you say is just the recording about the correlations that cannot be erased, it has to go somewhere. Yes, so I'm not sure I would suffer of fine tuning, but... yeah. Let me say, this is the most speculative part of my talk, clearly. Maybe you can articulate a bit more where you see the problem of fine tuning here.
No, I don't know. It was just because you said that you have something that's observed, that is the when the spots are cut, and then you have local causality in this case. But yeah. Before this cut, you have something. Maybe not.
It's just the mere existence of the fact that Alice and Bob are going to perform measurements are going to result into a cut of this spot. But clearly, like when you create these pairs, you didn't know if Alice and Bob would perform anything, and so that thing was not cut. And so I think to some later slides, I try to come up with what I think is the new causal structure for Bell's theorem in this case. I don't remember where. Yeah, this one.
Hey, Lorenzo, could I ask a question before you get here? Maybe it's a setup for what you're about to say, but the way I interpreted what Marina was asking, let me see if I can say something similar, that if we're on the right-hand side and we're talking about the subspots, then I can see not only would we derive, you know, something like a Bell inequality constraint, we could also derive the no signaling constraint. Now, when we move to the left side, where we're considering this thing as just a spot and not dividing into subspots, your point is that the PAB given X, Y, V could violate the Bell inequalities. Like it's not constrained to the way the V bar expressions were. But then the question is, does it also violate the no signaling constraint? Like, does that extra freedom, like what guarantees that it?
Yeah, I don't see why it should, but that's why I was asking if you
can. I guess I don't see why it shouldn't. That's because, maybe I'll go. Why don't you go on and talk about the causal structure now?
Yeah, no, actually, I didn't want to talk about the causal structure because, it was some extra slide after the finish. So let me finish and then we try to discuss this, okay? Let me just conclude this part by saying that so the possibility of helping us about the no-good theorems or how this framework can help us with the no-good theorems was exactly that you can conceive of probabilities that go bigger, exactly because you have these extra subspaces. Okay, this was more or less like the general intuition, and that's how I tried here to implement it. Somehow I apologize, I don't have like a proper treatment of this. It's just like a really more a speculation. And then I wanted to conclude now, and maybe later we can talk about causal structure. I want to conclude with, so what's next? So, because so far what we have done is really, so at the beginning I argued that the problem of the no-good theorems is this fine-tuning problem, and the lesson from them is that we should develop a new ontological framework for quantum theory that doesn't suffer these fine-tunings. What I've tried to do here is to develop this new framework, providing like a, let's say, a more natural framework where I remove some abstractions from the standard ontological models framework. Then I try to implement it in the theory of locales, of point-free topology. And then what's next is really to first try to develop a probability theory on locales, in particular to check whether all these speculations I just made are warranted or hold. And then the other thing I was happy to discuss is if there are other possibilities to implement this like a memory ontology idea in frameworks other than point free topology, other than locales. And so with this I want to conclude, and I want to say that I'm very curious to know what you think about that, if you have any feedback, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. We'll now take questions from the Zoom audience. You can raise your hand or speak up if no one is speaking yet. Go ahead, Rob.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks, Lorenzo. That was really interesting. Even though I've got a number of questions, I appreciate it's a speculative idea, so I'm not criticizing the speculative nature of it. I'm just trying to understand it better. First question, it feels to me like this idea of reality, something exists, is for something to exist is to be recorded. It reminds me a lot of the quantum Darwinism program. So in quantum Darwinism, the emphasis was maybe a little bit different. It was about, you know, what is classical information? Classical information is something that's redundantly encoded. But maybe that's just a kind of choice of language that, you know, somebody could say the only things that exist are classical things, and those are things that are redundantly encoded. So certainly I've heard quantum Darwinists like Robin Blumkuhn, for example, talk exactly in terms of this reality. So yeah, I guess my first question was just, do you see an affinity with the quantum Darwinist program and what you're talking about?
I have to say that I don't know much about quantum Darwinism. For me, quantum Darwinism would just try to give an explanation of how the classical world emerges. But maybe I'm wrong. I didn't think it was about providing, you know, an ontological framework for so what's the reality of quantum theory. So instead here, like the recordings are really like the ontological constituents of things. And actually, let me say that maybe I didn't say, but like for me, the idea is that, you know, if you need to describe the macroscopic world, then it's fine to describe it with points, you know, because you don't need to have this, you don't have to take care of the fact that you cannot record things with the precision of a point and so on, like if you go to the microscopy. And so in this sense, like I would have expected that, you know, quantum Darwinism, if it just wants to explain, you know, the macroscopy, like it doesn't even need to talk about recordings or like at least like, you know, having finite precision and stuff like that. But I don't know. Honestly, I never thought about that.
You brought me into a second question I had regarding the status of points. So I'm a little bit confused about the status of points because on the one hand, you know, early on and in response to my question, you said, well, we would like to exclude points of infinite sets, like continuous manifolds, for example, on the grounds that, you know, no measurements, you can't record infinite precision. So for that reason, points ought not to be there, ought not to have any reality. But then on the other hand, later in the talk, you sort of said, the important thing is that we don't start with points, but points do emerge as a certain limit, and it's okay for them to be there. But that seems to go against the finite precision argument you gave before. So
yes.
Are you saying that, like, what? And then you mentioned sort of the macroscopic limit as if that was something that could overcome the finite precision limit, where you could have infinite precision in the macroscopic limit. But maybe I misunderstood that. So
yeah,
can you tell me, wait, like which?
Yeah. Let me come out of that. So I think. So the way I see it is that there are two things that maybe I didn't make particularly clear. So one thing is in this like memory ontology framework, before we compare it with any theory, just the theory independent framework, it starts from spots, but you can conceive to have points. In particular, if you think about all the systems in the world recording, you know, you can have a feeling that, you know, you have this limit where you could record with the precision of a point, you know, because you could have like kind of infinite memory capacity if you consider the whole universe, okay? So I think there is no contradiction in thinking that, you know, you can conceive points in the framework as a limit, okay? Still starting from spots. But then there is another thing, maybe I didn't say. What I believe is that if now you try to tailor a model within this memory ontology framework for quantum theory, I think what quantum theory is gonna add is that there is a finite extent of spots. So spots cannot be, they cannot go to a point, okay? There is a finite extent that maybe it's related to a Planck constant, I don't know. And so in this respect, if you want to, develop memory ontology for quantum theory, then, you know, you have no points. That's just an intuition. And okay. And then instead, like if you want to tailor memory ontology for classical theory, which is like, let me banalize it, like just the theory of the macroscopic objects, then instead it's the opposite. You don't need to put a extent of the spots, you can actually just consider points. And that's why quantum Darwinism, you know, if you just want to explain the emergence of classicality, you just need points. You don't need to go to spots.
Okay, let me ask one quick follow-up and then I'll let other people ask questions. Just when you said you can kind of get over the finite precision limitation by considering the whole universe, I'm a bit confused because, you know, on the one hand, if I have just like a second subsystem in the universe that I'm using to record, well, if it has a kind of degree of freedom that's a manifold and you know, maybe it could learn to infinite precision because it's got enough variability in its state space to make that recording. On the other hand, if it's only got like a finite set of states, then it'll necessarily be limited to finite precision. But even, you know, even if we imagine that the subsystems in the universe each have like a finite number of states, so they can only do finite precision, you know, taking the whole universe just means I got a lot of them. I don't have an infinite number of them. So either way, it doesn't feel like taking the whole universe is the way to get infinite precision. So I'm still confused about like what are the assumptions that get you to finite precision in general, but infinite precision in some sort of macroscopic limit?
I'm not sure I got like why you say that. Why you cannot consider that the universe is so big that it can record, it has infinite extent and therefore it can have infinite memory capacity and record with the precision of a point. I don't understand what you said that challenges this.
I see. So then an assumption you're making is, okay, the universe has an infinite number of subsystems, all of which can only record to finite precision. But if I take into account the infinite number of subsystems that are in the
universe. Correct.
So that makes it kind of wedded to the notion that the universe is infinite in extent.
Yeah, but look, so let's be clear here. Like what I'm saying is that within this framework is theory independent, can accommodate for many different words, okay? They all need to be interpreted such that the element of reality are recordings, you know? But I can tailor a model within this framework where there is this infinite universe that record with the precision of a point in the limit. But then I can also tailor another model where instead places some restrictions. I'm not saying that in favor of one or the other, but at least that within this framework, you can contemplate both possibilities.
Okay. Well, let me move you on to some of the other questions. Thanks, Lorenzo.
Yeah, thank you.
Nico, I think you were next. Raise your hand.
Yeah. I have two questions. The first one is, at first, from your principal assumptions, it seems like you only need a sort of change of basis of your topological space and don't need this, what you mentioned, something related to H bar, which limits you to a finite size of your spots. Is there so you're basically adding this assumption on top of the ones you mentioned before?
Yes. So as I was saying, this could be a possible extra assumption that you only make when you want to tailor this theory independent mathematical framework to quantum theory specifically. This is like, I don't know, when you try to tailor the standard ontological models framework exactly for, classical theory. And so you say that the lambdas are points in the phase space and this is how the evolution works, blah, 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 are extra things you add to tailor a particular model for the operational theory you want. Can you repeat the idea that you were saying that instead of considering a finite extent, you can consider a change of basis? Because I think I didn't get that.
What I mean with that is that you're basically just changing the basis of your topology of the space.
Okay.
And you're going from a finer topology, which is point-like, to a coarser topology, which only includes the sets. But if you include infinite intersections, they are basically the same topology.
Okay. Thanks.
The other question was, you mentioned this infinite universe. Did you mean the real spatial extent or just the, let's call it the manifold on which the spots live, such that we have infinite precision to get to a point in that space?
I mean, I'm not sure what's the difference between two options. Like, I was just saying that if you assume that, you know, like you have a notion of infinite memory capacity, then you could conceive that you can record with the precision of a point from that perspective. Also, because let me state this again, like every time you say this is a system and this is a recorder, it's just fictitious what you choose, not fictitious, but it's just arbitrary what you choose to be the system and the recorder. So if now you make the recorder to be the entire universe apart from that system, and you say that universe is infinite in some topological sense, then you might conceive that you know, you could record with the precision of a point. But
so you're...
yeah, I don't know in terms of the two you know notions you use, like which one embraces what I just said.
Probably the one where you mean that the manifold itself is okay. Infinite in that sense, because I was wondering whether this might violate something like the difference between the universe and the observable universe. The one might not coincide with the other.
Okay, but yeah,
in that sense.
I'm not sure what this means. Like, what's the difference?
What I mean with that is that the observable universe has a given size, and if you say, okay, your infinity of memory comes only from the size of the physical universe, then I would imagine that only the one which is causally connected to the thing you want to observe can save the data, and therefore you can only use the observable universe to save the data for a given state.
Yeah, okay, I understand. Yes, this one, I think. Yeah.
Lucien, I think you raised your hand next.
Okay, thanks. So thanks for the talk. It was really interesting. And it's a courageous thing to do. I've wondered about going beyond the ontological models framework. And the way I always thought that one would do that would be to change the assumption that you have an ontic state at a given time. And the motivation for that modification would be that if you have something like quantum gravity and you have indefinite causal structure, then the idea of a definite time would stop making sense, so even more than it does in, say, special relativity, where there's a reference, at least in special and general relativity, you can still have a foliation, and so you can recover that notion. But if you have indefinite causal structure, then the notion would disappear. And then I'm wondering how. So that would have been my approach. But I'm wondering if what your thinking is around time, because time is given normally by a point in a space, but it's given by the more standard way of thinking about quantities. So have you thought about how time would fit into the kind of approach that you're taking?
Yeah, so the honest answer is that not that much, but I can share this thought. I think that even the notion of time in this picture can be associated to the act of recording. So it's like it would be like this dynamical variable between like the systems, but it would still fit in a notion, for example, of a block universe where there is like a non-notion of time. And it's yet another property of the recording. And so I was wondering when you were talking if this framework could accommodate also like your proposals to change like you know, how to define an ontic state at a given time. What else I want to say? So because I was thinking, I think I even wrote it in the research statement that the problem of time in quantum gravity, like in quantum theory settings, you know, like background parameter, gravity is more this yeah, like dynamical variable. You know, here maybe you can make sense of change in this universe exactly because time is a property of the you know, in the individual relation of the recording. Still, if the universe, still nevertheless, so even if the universe is defined by like a stationary eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, like it's like a block universe, and that's the only thing I thought about. But yeah, I feel like could accommodate like a more like dynamical notion of time, which is really related to the systems, to the relations between the recorders and the system, and but the globally, it's like a block universe. Yeah, I mean that's the only piece of information I can share about this.
Okay.
It's definitely interesting.
Then one other, just it's more of a question. You can go back to the slide where you're talking about bells. One slide before, I think. One before. That one, yeah, stop there. And so I'm having difficulty sort of connecting this sort of mathematical idea of locales with the philosophy that you're talking about. So if you take, for example, one of those quantities that appear there, you've got P of A, B given X, Y, and V.
Yeah.
So there's just in that quantity, there's several, there's one, there's P, there's A, there's B, there's X, there's Y, there's V. Should I be thinking of each of those quantities, in fact, as locales? Is P still a real number like it usually is? What about A? What about B? What about X? What about Y? And V, I think, is a locale for sure. But how should I think of each of those quantities?
Right. I think so. I mean, I was naively just thinking about, you know, replacing what was P of A, B, X, Y, lambda with P, A, B, X, Y, V. But now I agree, like, if lambda could just be considered as a classical variable like the others, now putting V like puts into question also what are the other variables.
They are actually recordings in some sense.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Honestly, I haven't thought about this, but yes.
Okay.
Yes, right. Yeah, I could think about this as existing within a locale. Yeah, and yeah, but honestly, like, this comes back to the question of really understanding what it means to define a probability theory on a locale. Okay, because then I can also say what it means, you know, that I have these, you know, what were these classical variables that you know, refer to the outcomes and the settings, and put them into what does it mean a probability of outcomes given settings and this hidden variable V. Yeah, but yeah, they should all live in a locale, and then P is just the probability on the locale. Yes,
it would maybe still be a real number in some sense, or but the others would be.
It's just a measure on a locale that it would be just a real number.
And then just, I mean, I wonder if you do that, it might help even more with getting around the Clausewitz-Neel argument.
Right.
Argument. And just one more question. So I'm trying to form a sort of image of how this splitting works. You've got the, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, the V cross symbol.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, is what is that? So that's the two halves in some sense, the two split parts.
Yeah.
Like this intuition. Yeah. Okay. That's the union.
Yeah.
Of the two parts separately. Okay.
Yes, but
so I don't really have an image of what all this means. I thought these were not quantic states as such; they were recording. So I'm struggling to find a mental image that.
Yeah. So
actually, okay.
Yeah, I had slides on this, but yeah, then I decided to remove them. But I think I can explain. In particular, I want to explain like the difference between this union, which is just taking really the collection of these open sets, and how this is different instead from the symbol I used before, which was the amalgamation, you know, of the subspots. And actually, let me find this the other slides I had on this, because I think this kind of you remember, like, let me take this example of the regular opens of the reals, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, they were just these open sets that coincide with the interior of their closure. Okay. So now I just wanted to say what does it mean, this operation of amalgamation versus the operation of the union? Because then above, I'm going to use the union, not the amalgamation, okay? So if now I imagine that I take, for example, you know, 3 points minus 1, 0, 1 that actually do not belong to this set, I can still define a notion of open set between 0 and 1, okay? And then also another open set, which is between minus 1 and 0. Now, if I ask what is this amalgamation between minus 1, 0, and 0, 1, the answer is not the union, because the union would be minus 1, 0, union, 0, 1, so without the 0. Instead, this amalgamation implies that I also include the 0 in this open set, which is the result. And the reason is that after the amalgamation, I want still to have a regular open, so something that the interior of the closure is equal to itself. And if I took this one without the 0, it wouldn't be like that, okay? So basically, in this case, for example, the union would be just to take really the disjoint collection of these open sets instead of doing the amalgamation. And when above I do this, where I consider this union of these subspots, okay? That's exactly what I want to capture. Because here, if I put the amalgamation, I will get back the entire spot, okay? But instead, I want to just say that I take only, you know, that these individual parts without, if you want, the information about the relationship between them. And that's why I have that they are not the same, these probabilities. Okay. This is the intuition.
Okay. And is there a way of thinking about this physically? Because I still find myself wanting to think about
physically,
are separated from the source and travel to the two ends, but I don't think you want me to think about like that.
Yeah, I mean, So physically, the way I think about this is that the subspots are about the new recordings that are associated with the observable quantity, so with the outcomes, okay? Instead, what is left, so okay, but still contributes to the probability, is really the what was the relationship between these subspots when they were in the big spot.
Okay.
That's how I think about that. I mean, it seems abstract, but in a notion of ontology where recordings is, you know, what it exists, and where things like as individual units do not exist, but everything is like a relational unit. So in the definition of what a thing is the relation it has with other things, then I think it's conceivable that there is always some information about the relationships. And this information cannot be erased, not even if, you know, this part goes space-like separated. That's how I think about it. But again, like this part of the talk is very speculative, and I also think that if I manage to come up with a probability theory on these locales, I can even get clearer on the on how to interpret all the things. You know, like that's really what I want to work on next. Like be clear on what these objects in the probability theory of locales are, and so how to interpret them physically. That's okay. that's really the main next open question.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for the questions.
Okay, so Aggie.
Thanks, Ellie, and thanks, Lorenzo. I really enjoyed this talk. So my question is kind of on the philosophy side. So you said that the standard ontological model framework of reality your proposal endorses with respect to the history of philosophy.
Yeah. So what's the question? Because I cannot hear you very well.
Oh, sorry.
It's based cutting. Yeah. What's the question?
Yeah. The question is, can you say something about what view of reality your proposal endorses with respect to the history of philosophy?
Yes. Yeah, thanks for the question. Actually, I can give also, some a bit of history how I came up with all these ideas. So I think a couple of years ago, I gave like the first like kind of informal talk about these ideas. And I was depicting all this picture I was drawing about the picture of the world being interconnected, the reality being about recordings, blah, blah. Then there was someone in the audience who told me, but look, like what you're describing is a Whitehead process philosophy. So I was like, well, I don't know what's Whitehead. You know, I didn't study it at school. So then I started to Google it, and apparently I got extremely fascinated. I bought the book of Whitehead. I started to watch many lectures about it. And because I think this is really close to the process reality of Whitehead's philosophy. The only difference is that Whitehead was talking about feelings instead of recordings, because he didn't have, you know, like the physics to talk about that. You know, instead, I think with the advent of information theory, quantum information, for me it was clear that these things were just recordings. But yeah, so it's close to process reality and Whitehead philosophy as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, with some differences.
Okay, thanks. So I guess it's not really a follow-up question, but another question. And maybe the problem is that I'm not so familiar with the concept of recordings in quantum information theory. So maybe this question doesn't even make sense, but the name of your proposal has the word memory in it. And it just made me think, you know, is there any limit to how long the record needs to exist? You know, the record needs to be kept for something to be considered to exist. Like, you know, does it have to be a permanent record, or does like the thing only exist as long as the record exists? Can records be wiped?
No. The actual point, I mean, the point is exactly that if you erase the record, then that thing doesn't exist anymore. You know, like things exist only as long as there is a record. And I can tell you also another motivation why I got into this is that I was, you know, studying this, probably you heard of this Frankinger-Renner paradox. And for me, like in my eyes, the resolution of the paradox basically was to change one of the assumptions that basically assumed that you could promote the certainty of another observer to your certainty, even if in the while the outcome is erased, okay? And that for me was unacceptable, because for me, if something is erased, it doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't make any sense to say about, oh yeah, that thing has value. This is if in the while that thing doesn't exist anymore. And so this is yet another reason why I think I really thought it was important to say that, you know, existence coincide with, you know, things being recorded. And also because like in a, you know, Leibnizian flavor, if you want, you cannot draw a difference between something that you say doesn't exist and something about which there is no memory anywhere in the world. Therefore, it means they coincide. So no recording means no existence.
So do I think of the records as like just really something like basic, like something that's recorded, or is there some more technical definition?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is a good question. I mean, characterizing what really means the recording is one of the open questions of this framework, honestly. But yeah, at the moment, I would just think about it just intuitively.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
So I want to just thank the speakers so much. Thank you, Lorenzo, for your talk. It's definitely interesting ideas. And I look forward to seeing where this goes next. Thank you.
Thank you. I liked it a lot. Thank you.